Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beats. I personally take Super Beats when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beats gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at intelligentbeats.com. That's intelligentbeats.com. Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're talking to cardiologist and coenzyme Q10 expert, Dr. Peter Langgen. In part one, we talked about statins and their relative disadvantages. And in fact, some of this is based on an article which has the tantalizing title of How Statistical Deception Created the Appearance That Statins Are Safe and Effective in Primary and Secondary Prevention of Cardiovascular Disease. And Dr. Langgen is a statin skeptic, doesn't believe that they're what they're cracked up to be, and in fact have a wide array of negative effects. So in part two, let's turn our attention to coenzyme Q10, which is promising in cardiovascular disease treatment and prevention. Give us a little background on what turned your father on to coenzyme Q10, and then how you got into the family business, so to speak.
Right. Well, CoQ10, it's remarkably simple in many ways. It's the cofactor or coenzyme for the enzyme systems in our cells that make 95% of all cell energy. And it's a very, very powerful antioxidant. We don't call it a vitamin because we can make our own. It naturally peaks in our 20s, starts to go down in your 30s. And then you become more dependent upon it from dietary sources, which are mostly organ meats. Heart has the most. So chicken hearts, for instance, would be a really high source of CoQ10 in the diet, and then liver is number two, has about half the concentration. And early on in the Q world, when it was realized that this relatively simple small molecule was absolutely essential, or the mitochondria do not produce ATP, it was logical to look at heart muscle, because heart muscle has a huge concentration of CoQ10 normally. Roughly a third of the volume of the heart is mitochondria, so it's more than any other organ. And so in animal models, it became clear that heart failure was associated with low Q when measured in the heart muscle. And then in human studies in the 70s, was mostly in Denmark, showed that with heart failure, you could take a biopsy of the heart and the level was lower than normal, and then if you had severe heart failure, it was even significantly lower yet. So based on that, that's when that information was available. My father started looking at idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathies, and these were very, very sick people. It was at Scott and White Hospital at the time, and first did a double-blind placebo crossover trial using CoQ10 in these heart failure patients, and showed a significant improvement, which was really something, because normally you can't fundamentally improve heart muscle function.
Right, and in fact, this is a big problem, because we're seeing a trend towards maybe less coronary artery disease, less heart attacks. Perhaps the statistics are a little better on that, but we're seeing more and more people, maybe they survive longer, their hearts are weakened by successive bypasses, maybe statins themselves, and we have an epidemic of congestive heart failure where we really don't have good drugs. We have drugs that can sort of ameliorate it, but we don't really have something that can power up the heart and make it beat strongly again.
No, we don't. The only thing we do have is Q, which in that respect works great. At any rate, so these early trials, nobody really knew what dose of Q to use. We used 100 milligrams just because we thought, well, that did get their blood levels up usually to, quote, normal. But it wasn't enough.
In fact, there were some negative studies around that, too. There were some studies as well, you know, CoQ10's not what it's cracked up to be. And, you know, I saw those studies,
They had blood levels that were, by today's standards, considered subtherapeutic. And so with time, a couple of things happened. One is CoQ10 became more available at more reasonable prices than it was, let's say, in around 1980. And then we had access to much, much better CoQ10 assays. The early assays were long and tedious and not all that darn accurate. And then the newer technology is super good. And so we could accurately, readily, easily measure Q levels either in tissue or blood. And then we had good formulations of Q where we could get blood levels up much higher than we did before. And we found that over time that you needed to have blood levels up above 3.5 micrograms per milliliter. And to put that in perspective, someone with heart failure without any Q may have a level as low as 0.3 in that range, or sometimes 0.5. A normal person without any disease, on no statins and on no Q, may have a level of 1.5, you know, in that range. Well, if you take the heart failure patient with a level of 0.5 and you double it and you make them normal at around 1, they're not going to get better. They'll get this real slight changes.
Right.
You have to get the level up about 3 times normal, so around
3.5 or 4. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
because I use your assay precisely to hit that target.
Yeah, and that it makes a really big difference. And then what we've done later, especially with Q that's even better absorbed, like ubiquinol, we can see levels now as high as 18 or 19.
Whoa! Wow!
And if you measure heart function very carefully, and you get people's level, let's say up to 4 or 5 in that range, and their ejection fraction goes from, let's say it was a low of 20%, and you get it up to 40%, 60% being normal. So you doubled it, you've improved their quality of life, they're much better. You know, they're completely out of the I need a implantable defibrillator range, for instance, and they're out of the range of, you know, heart transplant kind of.
Right.
But they're not normal. Well, if you double them again, and say if their level's 4 and you bump it up to 8 or 10 or 12, we don't see any further improvement.
It plateaus at a certain point.
In heart function.
Yeah.
Yeah. It plateaus around 4 or so. And if we bump it up beyond that, we usually don't see any further change.
Well, what sort of doses of CoQ10 or alternatively ubiquinol, we'll talk a little bit about ubiquinol in a moment, are necessary to achieve a blood level of 4, which is the target for someone with congestive heart failure?
Yeah. Your average person, and it varies a little with body weight, but also there's variability in how well people absorb Q, any form of it. But usually, if someone's taking, let's say, 200 milligrams twice a day, they'll get easily a level above 3.5. And our assumption is we need these higher blood levels to maybe force or to attain higher tissue levels, for instance, you know, in the heart muscle. And that's not been proven. We don't have enough heart muscle data to see if that's the case. But empirically, we know we have to get it up above that high. And, you know, that's over the years, which actually right now it's 30 years of experience with using Q.
Well, let me share a personal anecdote with us. So this must have happened, I think it happened in the 1980s, because I kind of can situate myself in my first office, which I gave up in the late 80s to move to a larger office. I remember that I had a patient who was an overweight woman who had congestive heart failure, and also she was a little bit of a eccentric person, because she always had to carry with her, maybe she was a little obsessive. She always had to have like one of these Rolly carriers to carry all her stuff. And so I would always see her, you know, huffing and puffing. In those days, I would practice in a brownstone, so she actually had to climb stairs to get to my office. Not a very good office for congestive heart failure patients. And so this was in the early days of awareness about coenzyme. So I told her to take coenzyme Q10. I think I told her at first to take 50 twice daily, because in those days we were using small doses. And then I read, you know, commentary that maybe that wasn't enough. So I said, all right, take 100 twice daily. And so she said, you know, I need to do this because I'm going to visit my daughter in San Francisco. It's going to be a very arduous trip, and I'm going to be doing a lot of walking, so I really want something to help me. So she comes back, and I asked her, you know, how'd it go? And she said, it really went well, but I did something different. You told me to take 200. Well, instead, I took 400. And when I took 200, I noticed there was some slight improvement, but I decided to double it up, even though you didn't tell me to double it up. And at 400, I noticed a distinct improvement. I was really tooling around quite well. You know, San Francisco is very hilly, and I was able to go up and down those hills with my daughter, and I had a pretty good time. So that's the dawning awareness that, you know, these original doses, and of course, in, you know, early on, CoQ10 was expensive, as you say. It was kind of like the era of the first flat-screen televisions that cost $6,000. Then with mass production and new techniques, you know, we got the price point down to like, you know, $499. And similar things have been happening in the CoQ10 industry. It's a commodity, and there's a lot of competition. So we're seeing a dose-response effect. And so you think that the sweet spot may be achieved with as little as 400 milligrams of CoQ10?
Yeah, it varies. It's nice to, and it depends on which type. We should go ahead and say that, you know, for many, 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 many years, 100% of the Q used it everywhere in the world, in animal or human studies, was in its oxidized state. It's called ubiquinone. And it's a nice, stable, brilliant orange powder that we've had a ton of experience with. One Japanese company, Konica, developed the methodology to make bulk CoQ10 in what we call its reduced state. It's also called ubiquinol. That's a white powder. It doesn't have any color to it. It's not as stable, but it's available as a supplement. And we've studied it in normal, healthy people, and then we've also studied it in critically ill, end-stage class 4 heart failure.
And that was a person who can barely get across the room. They're huffing and puffing.
People who are, their life expectancy is measured in months, not years. And in healthy people, it's roughly twice as well absorbed as ubiquinone. By the same company, same, you know, fillers and what have you. In sick people, heart failure patients, and I think this is in part because they have a lot of gut edema, you know, swelling and fluid in their belly.
Yep.
It's about easily up to four times better absorbed.
Wow, okay.
So in the really sick people, at least in my practice nowadays, we use strictly ubiquinol, because you don't have a whole lot of time to fool around with, you know, less well-absorbed products, because you've got to get them better as quick as you can.
Right. So, and what dosage are you seeing benefits for these very heart-limited patients with ubiquinol?
Yeah, we use, we will start them out on 200 milligrams of ubiquinol, three times a day, taken with meals.
So that's 600 total.
Yeah. Right. And then we'll give that 2 or 3 weeks, and we'll check their level. You know, if their level is 8 or 9 or 10, or as one of our patients today, 18, they can easily drop that down to 200 twice a day and do just as well. And
right.
Save money. So that's what we do when we, you know, don't have a lot of time. People who are less sick will often start them on 200 twice a day.
Right.
These are heart failure patients.
Right.
And then there's lesser degrees of that. I mean, you can have some relatively small person, 110-pound patient that's, you know, has some mild impairment in heart muscle function, not critically ill by any means. You could easily see if 100 milligrams twice a day would do it. And many times that works fine.
Well, what about
that's kind of the range.
So there's a lot of people out there who are taking either coenzyme Q10 or these days more and more people are taking ubiquinol for general enhancement. Do you think that, taking CoQ10 or ubiquinol for somebody who's otherwise healthy? I personally take ubiquinol 100 milligrams twice daily, and I don't have any degree of heart failure. I just do it because, I'm 62. I understand that endogenous production of CoQ10 drops. It doesn't affect just the heart. It affects multiple organ systems. It could be a beneficial antioxidant. It could be protective to the brain. There are actually neurologists who are using super high doses of CoQ10 or ubiquinol for Parkinson's disease, for ALS, for Alzheimer's, neurodegenerative conditions. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's a big topic. As far as staying healthy, of course, that's something we know the least about. But it's, I think, the most important, really. What you're doing, 100 milligrams twice a day, sounds great. It wouldn't hurt someday to check your level and see what it is. But
I can do that very easily. That's a good idea.
What's interesting about Q, and it's not true of very many things at all that I can think of, is there's about a threefold variation in individual absorption of Q. So if you take 100 college kids that are roughly the same age and weight and that are theoretically devoid of diseases or drugs, you'll see, and you give them all the same type of Q, and you give them, let's say, 100 milligrams a day for a month, and you check their levels, and you count their pills, and you try to get as good a compliance as you can, you're going to see about a threefold variability in their levels. And that's been shown by over and over and over and over and over again by everybody who studies Q. And we have no idea why that is. I mean, there are some people who absorb Q so well, it's just unbelievable. And others don't.
Maybe a genetic factor.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but it'd be really nice to know, actually. But
What about for people who take statins? You know, like despite our concerns and criticisms of statins in part one, there's a very sizable percentage of the population who are they're going to be afraid to go off their statins. They rely on statins, they believe, to safeguard them against cardiovascular disease or stroke. And so,
often under huge pressure to take
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So, typically, can that blockage of CoQ10 production be overcome by taking outside CoQ10, or is it just a Band-Aid?
No. It can. I mean, you can attain normal Q levels by supplementing statin patients.
It must be variable, but how much does it usually take?
Yeah, it depends on their dose. Right. But it's. It could be anywhere, let's say, between 2 and 400 milligrams a day.
Of CoQ10 or of ubiquinone or ubiquinol?
What you would do is just sort of double the number if you're using ubiquinone.
Okay. Okay. Most reliably, this brings up the issue of, someone who has decided to be on a statin and is taking CoQ10, maybe it'd be worthwhile to get a blood test at a doctor who is CoQ10 savvy to determine if you're hitting that milestone of a 3 or
a
4 on your level.
Yeah, and even the commercial labs are offering Q levels.
But perhaps you could ask even your primary care doctor. Maybe they'll humor you and order the test. And maybe they're not too sympathetic to the notion of CoQ10.
Yeah, well, what it does, if you continue to take a statin and you take a reasonable amount of Q, you will have less of the fatigue you'll have less of the muscle symptoms in general. It doesn't affect the memory loss because you still have that drop in cholesterol in your brain. And as far as heart failure goes, which is a current big interest of ours, statin-induced heart failure, you cannot turn that around unless you stop the statin.
Okay.
And the reason is these other compounds that are necessary for heart muscle function, like heme A is a big one. And we, early on, like in the 1990s, we thought that if you took enough Q, you could prevent statin cardiomyopathy. What we've realized over the last 5 or 6 years is that's not possible.
So it's only a partial ameliorative. It's not like a complete fix for the deficits that the statins cause.
Yeah, and when you think about it, it can't be, because there's too many other compounds essential for cell function. So you're only addressing one. But it does help a little bit. I mean,
So your lab is, in addition to being a clinician, you're actively researching CoQ10. What's on the launch pad in terms of some of your research projects? What can we expect to hear from you in terms of
things? Yeah, that we're doing right now. One, we're going to publish in the next few months. It's completed. We're just in the process of writing it, and it's about 150 patients with statin cardiomyopathy, and that involves a ton of wonderful information. And then the second thing that we're working on, that we haven't fulfilled our recruitment goal for yet, is what's called the aging heart. There's an assumption in medicine that after the age of about 70 or 75, it's normal to have mild impairment in heart muscle function. And the term for that is grade 1 diastolic dysfunction. That's considered normal for age. Some terms that were used for senile heart. And what we found, earlier work, just to see what would happen, we found that that's not the case. It's reversible. So it's not normal for age if you can reverse it. So we have now a study where we're looking at elderly people who are perfectly healthy in every respect. So they're not on any medicines, they're not on vitamins, they're not on statins, they don't have hypertension. You know, so you have to find these elderly, healthy people. Then you do an echocardiogram on them, and lo and behold, virtually all of them that we've checked so far have at least grade 1 diastolic dysfunction, so not grade 2.
Which is a sort of a floppy, inefficient heartbeat in a way.
Right, right. It's like a impairment in the uncoupling of actin and myosin, so it's like a stiffening of the heart, so it doesn't work as good as a pump. Any rate, and then we check their Q level, we check their echo, and then we put them all on, we're using 200 twice a day ubiquinol, and we're remeasuring their hearts at 6 months, and to see if it reverses or whatever it does. And like I say, that's ongoing, and I'm probably won't get that completed and published till next year.
Okay. Well, sounds like you're on the case, looking at the potential downsides of statins as well as ways to ameliorate them, at least in part, and also to reverse that aging process, which causes people to end up with congestive heart failure. Coenzyme Q10 has certainly been no flash in the pan. I think CoQ10 is truly a poster boy for a nutraceutical that has very, very profound medical benefits. It's something that came to us via the health food store, but it has some extraordinary medical applications. So for those conventional doctors who say, hey, it can't be good, sold in a health food store, CoQ10 certainly gives the lie to that particular worldview. So thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Langston. And, congratulations on a remarkable career, which has really brought Coenzyme Q10 and ubiquinol to the forefront and the public has certainly embraced this to the great benefit, I think, of a large number of people. And I think we're only scratching the surface of the potential of these remarkable substances. So keep up the research, and let's validate some of these ideas. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, I certainly enjoyed the conversation, and we'll keep plugging away.
It's been a great pleasure. So for our listening audience, today's Intelligent Medicine Call to Action, are there resources that people can look to find out more about the subject?
They could go to thincs.org, thincs.org. That has good information on the whole sort of the cholesterol mythology.
Okay.
So that's one good source of information. They can go to the International CoQ10. Yeah, it's called ICQA.org. Actually, if they went to my website, that has abstracts of all my papers on it.
And, okay, so give us a spelling of that, please. That's Peter Langgen.
For that website, it's Dr. Langgen.
Oh, okay, so that's a tough name for some people. It's Langsjoen.
Right.
Okay, you can curse your Danish ancestry for that spelling. It's I'll put it up on our website, of course. It's Langsjoen, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, and that's .com. drlangen.com. Yep. Okay, great. So that'll point our listeners to some helpful resources, because we've got real nutrition aficionados and health professionals who want to learn more about this subject. Thanks so much for joining us, and once again, congratulations on this wonderful work that has validated the importance of these substances. Thanks. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.